I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. There are a number of reasons why people don't make a financial plan. Some think they don't earn enough to save regularly. Others think investing is too complicated or too risky. And young adults might think financial planning is only necessary for those looking to retirement. But financial planning is beneficial to people at all ages and income levels. And joining us to discuss financial planning strategies is Jason Lilly, Chief Wealth Management Services Officer at Cape Cod 5. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mindy. It's great to be back on the show.
Yeah, good to see you. All right, let's start by addressing some of the reasons people might not be seeking help for financial planning. We know that many people are struggling simply to make ends meet. Financial planning is probably the last thing on their minds. So why is it important for somebody who's living paycheck to paycheck to have a financial plan?
I would answer that for those very reasons. So oftentimes, people think financial plan is, like you said, for the more affluent or those that have a little bit of a cushion and aren't paycheck to paycheck. But that financial education and empowerment is really what planning is all about. And applying that, you know, at that level, figuring out how to create a budget to create a little bit of wiggle room where they can then start to plan and save for retirement, a college education, that's really what it's all about. So it can be really, really impactful for, you know, folks that are in that situation.
So what might a financial plan look like for someone who doesn't have much, if any, money left over after they pay the bills? Because I always hear that, pay yourself first. And I think, okay, then what do you do about the electric bill and the mortgage and that?
Yeah, exactly. I have daughters, and when they were probably about 2 years old, I started talking about the golden rule. And the golden rule in our house is to save 20%. So before they even knew what a percent was, they knew how to respond to when I said, what's the golden rule? So I started early with them. But I found that, you know, works well for one child, not so good for the other. So when you're in a situation where you know, you're living paycheck to paycheck, you haven't really figured out how to create that extra additional cushion room to start planning for the future. The first most important thing, I think, in my mind, is just to get a better handle on that. There's always some areas where you can not necessarily shave. You know, I don't want people to think about they have to sacrifice current consumption, if you will, for the future. It's really more about right-sizing your current budget. And so the first thing to do is just actually create a budget. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a pain, right? Mm-hmm. Do I really need to go through that exercise? Ugh. It doesn't have to be that bad, and it doesn't have to be that detailed. But you really want to get a sense of where those dollars are going. And if you do that, almost always you'll find a place where you can take a little bit off. It's things that you don't necessarily use or need, or maybe not at the same level, and use those extra found cash to start saving for rainy day or retirement or college savings.
Mm. I'm just thinking, when you do stop and look at how you're spending your money, there's a lot of surprises in there. You know, you think, okay, that, you know, latte or that whatever every single day at the end of the week or end of the month really adds up.
Yes.
Yeah. So
Yeah, it does.
You can be surprised when you look at that. So what about those who know they should think about savings and investment, but just don't? They don't know where to start. It can be complicated. And
yes.
As you said, budget. I have to do a budget.
Right. How? Yeah. Where do I begin? There's a lot of tools out there. At Cape Cod 5 on our website, we actually have a budgeting tool. It's a great place to start. There's other digital tools out there and websites. Mint.com is another example. You almost, in many instances, don't even need to manually key that in. If you opened up an account, which is free on mint.com, not that, you know, I'm recommending Mint.
This is Mint. One of many. Okay.
This is one of many. Personal Capital is another one that does something similar. But anyway, you can bring in your different bank accounts, credit card accounts, and everything, and it will pre-populate. There's some risks with that, some security risks, but that is an example. Another example is online tools like we have available at Cape Cod 5.
All right, so young adults, those in their 20s and 30s, might think they have years before they have to worry about financial planning. And I remember hearing Pam Kruger from Money Track replying, compounding interest as a response to why young adults should be thinking about retirement savings. So explain why young adults have an advantage even if they only have a small amount.
Yeah, it is... It is a a huge advantage, this time value of money. It's something that I think everyone should have at least a general understanding of. Having twins in my house, I wrote an article. This was a few years ago, but it was basically I used my girls as an example, and one of them started saving their summer earnings, $2,000 a year at age 15, and the other one didn't do anything until age 30. The first one saved $2,000 from 15 to 30, and then nothing else, so a total of $30,000. The other one didn't start until age 30 and then saved $2,000 a year until age 65. Guess which one had more at the end?
The one who started saving at 15.
Yeah, because of that compounding effect. And those years that you can add in that the compounding, it just grows and grows that much faster.
Okay,
and
we should say your girls are not 85, by the way.
No, they're 13. So they still
this
have
was
an
exercise.
This right? was yeah, an yeah, exercise. Yeah, yeah. yeah. So, yeah, basically starting at 15, going to 30, and then nothing else, and then starting at 30 and going to 65. But the idea was looking at that ending balance at age 65, and the message was starting early can have a dramatic impact on end results.
So what about young adults coming out of college with a lot of student debt? Which is more important, paying down that debt or saving?
Both.
Both, yeah.
So then, all right. So you get out of college and, you know, or you're committed to start saving for retirement. You know, that's important. You want to do that. You have college debt that you need to pay down. You want to get your own place. You're sick of living in the basement or over the garage. So you have a multitude of goals, right? And how do you manage all of that? And how do you make progress in one or all of them at the same time? That's a hard thing to do. And oftentimes you just throw up your arms and say, I don't know. I'll figure it out tomorrow. And then tomorrow turns into age 30 and then 35 and then 40. So I think financial planning or a financial advisor that really looks at that holistic view can help a lot. Again, a lot of different educational tools. So educating, empowering, really, really, really important. One of our missions at Cape Cod 5 as well.
Yeah. I said, this is kind of before we had direct deposit. I'm just thinking of a friend of mine. She used to have envelopes that she had a door in her, office, and she'd put these envelopes, and one was like me. She paid herself first, and then she'd have all her other little envelopes that she would stick the money into through the month.
Yes, there is a great for your listeners. There is a great YouTube video. Go to YouTube and type in Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman. And it's a minute long YouTube video. I don't know if you're aware, but they used to be roommates, and they're really good friends.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
So I don't want to give it away. It's only a minute, but it reinforces that exact principle. So Dustin Hoffman used to use glass jars. And again, it kind of reinforces what he learned as a child. So he had these glass jars all set up, and Gene comes over and he asks Gene if he can borrow some money. Gene's looking at these glass jars and they're full of money. And he's like, well, sure, no problem, but why? He's like, well, I can't touch those jars. It's hilarious.
Yeah. All right. So learning good habits start early. So when should you start talking with children about savings and investment, and how do we get them learning these habits early? You mentioned you started talking to your girls at age 2?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that early.
That early. Yeah. There's two things I imparted upon them. The golden rule, save 20%, and that we're going to hike Kilimanjaro one day. I think starting early is really important. And it's not so much trying, at least in my view, trying to impart words of wisdom or specific concepts or goals, but just kind of in more of a informal way, guiding them. So at about age 5 or so, we started the Christmas gift experience. And so we would give them a budget where they could go out and buy Christmas gifts for the family. And we let them decide. So you can imagine at age 5, we'd go to the dollar store. I think the budget was $10 for anyone that they wanted to buy gifts. And we didn't put any restriction on who that would be or how much they had to spend. And it was really interesting to see how over the years that has developed and they've learned. So the first year out, get through the door. They've blown all their money on the shiniest thing they can find for grandma, you know, their both grandmothers. And they didn't have any money left for, I think they did the grandmothers and each other, but they didn't have any money left for the parents or anyone else. And so the next year they get a little bit better and the gifts started to change where they were more reflective of what, you know, who they're gifting for would actually want. So this year, again, did the same exercise. And it was really interesting to see that one of my girls was very, very thoughtful about, she knew her sister wanted a water bottle. We went to three different stores and there's one for like $8. It was, I think, TJ Maxx. And then there's another one that was $50 that she knew her sister would love. And then there was one for $25. She only had a $30 budget at this point, and she really wanted the $50 one. But she, you know, I said, I'll loan you the money, but it's a loan. You have to pay me back. And she contemplated that. She ended up going with the middle of the road one.
Oh.
And yeah, but it was great to have her go through that. We went through three stores twice as she processed this whole thing and came to the decision that she came to.
Now, you mentioned the whole saving things with one of the girls that works pretty well and the other one not so much. Now, you're teaching them the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
That's a really, really great question. And also, I think, important to recognize in your children. You know, you're not necessarily going to get the personality that reflects you or your habits. And broadly, there's basically three broad categories. We have our savers, our spenders, and our sacrificers. So saver, spender, pretty straightforward. Sacrificer is someone who would, you know, give up potentially something that could be theirs for someone else. So, you know, they tend to think of everybody else before they think of themselves. And I've got identical twins, so not just twins, but identical twins. And one is very much a saver, and one is very much a spender. And they hear the same message and same reinforcement, but that is their personality set. And what is really interesting is, I think, and important is the self-awareness. So they're pretty, you know, comfortable in who they are, and they recognize that my saver, I mean, it's like pulling teeth to get her to think about spending some money. She wants this game for her phone. It's $1. She's not quite sure. Where the other one is dropping $5 here and there for this game. She uses it twice. She's like, that didn't work. I don't, you know, and then off to the next one. She's out of her Amazon, out of her iTunes card within, you know, 30 days of getting the gift. And the other one has a $29.
All of it's still left.
Yeah, a year later. So the blend of the two, we've noticed over time, really starts to help. They manage each other a little bit, trying to get the saver to, you know that it's okay to consume a little bit, and the spender to pull back. So they were in Boston with a friend, and it was interesting because the spender, you know, we each gave him some money to go into the city with her friends. She immediately turned and gave it to her sister. So, see, you deal with this.
You help me.
All right.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have comments or questions this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Jason Lilly, who heads the Wealth Management Department at Cape Cod 5. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. We're talking about financial planning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Mary. She says, most stories of long-term saving assume returns of 6% per year. Right now, stocks are unreliable and banks give no interest. So where is it safe to save and still get a reasonable return? I'm what you call risk adverse. Thanks, Mary.
Yeah, that's a great question, Mary. So I guess what I'd like to explore a little bit more, I wish you were here, we could talk in person, is this idea that stocks are, what was it, unreliable?
Unreliable.
I think over the long term, they become more reliable. Short term, absolutely. We don't know on a day-to-day or even month-to-month basis if they're going to be higher or lower. But I think over the long term, history has shown that they actually can provide some return as long as you're comfortable with the roller coaster
and
ride
waiting,
thing.
Waiting, right?
That, yeah, you need to wait, and you need to be patient, and you need to be able to, what I call, have investment composure, knowing that it's going to go down at some points, and it can go down considerably, but three steps up, one step back, and be able to kind of look out and be okay with that. So if I could encourage you to revisit the stock, and it doesn't have to be a large portion, it can be a small portion, 20 to 30% in stocks can have a material impact on that compounding effect. You know, we had talked earlier, and I gave the twins example, but if you that assumed that both were invested the same way. If you're invested in cash or fixed income that currently have very, very low yields, the compounding effect is not nearly as great. Mm. So that's one thing to think about. The other thing to think about is we have investment returns, portfolio returns, and then we have personal rate of returns. And if you are adding on a consistent basis, even if it's a small amount, but if you're adding to your retirement savings, it does a couple of things. A, it improves your rate of return because of those additions, and it mutes the downside portion of the stock piece that you have invested in the portfolio. So that dollar cost averaging acts as a bit of a buffer. Diversification will help as well, not having all your eggs in any particular stocks or area of the stock market. On the fixed income side, rates have been moving higher. And I think over time, as we what they call normalize interest rates, things will be a little bit higher and you'll be able to see a little bit more income. And you also get some compounding effects off that income that those fixed income assets generate.
We're going to talk about retirement savings in a couple minutes. But first, last time we had you on, there were some new regulations for financial advisors issued by the Department of Labor requiring financial advisors to act in the best interest of their clients. Kind of shocking that that hasn't been the rule all along.
It is.
So first, what's the definition of a financial advisor?
Okay. I got to add this before we jump into that. So last time we were on, we had this very conversation. I think Pam Kruger was with us. After that interview, I got a phone call in the parking lot from my mother. And she said, "You got to be kidding me. You mean they can't? I can't believe that there needs to be a rule that you advisors have to act in clients' best interest." Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So with that as a backdrop, the other challenge in our industry is these titles aren't very descriptive, and they're not consistent across. So you could find yourself in front of what they call a title of a financial advisor, but that could be an insurance broker. It could be an equities broker. So unfortunately, financial advisor doesn't necessarily have a strict definition. It takes a little bit more of work, due diligence,
homework,
if you will.
Yeah,
homework a little bit, yeah. And have some things that can share with you a few questions to ask.
But what about this rule of acting in the client's best? Is that still the rule?
Yeah,
does that still apply?
Yeah, so this Department of Labor issued this fiduciary rule. Fiduciary is a duty of loyalty and care. And so, again, advisors should be acting in this duty of loyalty and care. And loyalty is, first and foremost, client's best interest should come first, right? I mean, that should be a given. The duty of care is a little bit more complicated, in my opinion, because when we think about care and we think about our industry, right, in wealth management, it is very complicated. And I can say I have experience in planning. I've been in this industry for over two decades in investment management, but I don't know a lot about life insurance and annuities. I've never been licensed to sell those. I know from a intellectual standpoint, from a mathematical standpoint, and from a conceptual standpoint how they can fit in a client's portfolio, but I don't know the intricacies. And so I don't, you know, when I think about care, it's competence. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be competent in those particular areas. But as a holistic wealth manager, I would know where to find fiduciary resources that have a competence in those areas.
So what are the questions we should be asking before choosing an advisor?
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. We want to get back real quickly to the DOL rule.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah, let me answer that. So it has been delayed to middle of 2019.
So it hasn't gone into effect yet.
Well, it sort of has. And this is actually really interesting. Part of it, this best interest idea, has gone into effect, should be in effect. And actually, I pulled a quote, let me see if I can find it, from the Labor Secretary, Alexander Acosta, who told lawmakers the best interest standard under the Labor Department's fiduciary rule is in effect and it's ready to take action against willful violation of those rules. One of the challenges, though, with the Department of Labor, they're not really an enforcement organization. And so what we have seen actually here in Massachusetts is regulators have taken action. Against Scottrade is the most recent example. Scottrade had, just real high level, I'm not making a case one way or the other, but there is a lawsuit against Scottrade. They had a national, allegedly, they had a national sales campaign that awarded their advisors for bringing in new assets, and that included IRA assets. So it's important to note that the DOL, these rules are specific to ERISA plans, IRAs, 401ks, et cetera. That goes against that best interest contract. And so we'll see what happens.
Right.
States have also started to initiate their own fiduciary standards. And then SEC has come out recently with expectations that they're going to also come out with some rules and standards, or at least have a communication at some point this year. And I think SEC, that would be a huge benefit because they do have the ability to make rules and enforce those rules. And they also oversee the investment management industry, which is $66 trillion and basically encompasses everything. So would be great.
So before we go to the phone, tell us what are we asking when we're going to the advisors?
Yeah, that's great. So I have about five really good questions to ask. The first question is experience and credentials. So you want to get a good understanding of what that advisor's experience has been. The credentials are really important. Again, in my industry, unfortunately, this is not as transparent as it should be. There's hundreds of different investment credentials. Two that really stand out, though, are the CFP, Certified Financial Planning Designation. And in my opinion, that fiduciary standard that is outlined in the CFP is probably the highest standard. Unfortunately, it only applies to the areas that you're providing planning advice in. And it also, the CFP does, as an organization, doesn't really have that enforcement. They can censor advisors, but they can't really put them behind bars. But very, very high standard. And so that's one of the benefits. Also, the CFP, as you go through that coursework, it's very, very broad-based. You can't get that designation and not have a good understanding of wealth management, of financial planning. Doesn't mean advisors are going to be great and really good, but it does mean they have a level of competence. The other one is Chartered Financial Analyst, CFA. That's very specific to the investment world. Again, very difficult credential to get. Doesn't guarantee success in investing, but it does guarantee a pretty high level of competence.
All right. Let's talk to Paul, who's giving us a call from Edgartown. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First thing is it's ironic. I have identical twins. they're in their mid-20s.
Oh, wow. Are they best friends?
They actually live together up in the Boston area. They both graduated. They have psych degrees and so it was very interesting. And the larger point that I have is that before they can get to a financial planner, and you touched on it a little bit at the beginning of the show, they have to have funds to do that, even if it's not 20% of their income. It speaks to the minimum wage. I'm a proud father of five.
Wow.
Them graduated college.
Amazing.
The ones that picked the more lucrative careers are doing okay and have funds to plan. But I have three of them that, unfortunately, they're after a college degree, their professions earn them about $12 an hour. Hmm. And when you live inside the Boston area, even if you're living with your brother, it doesn't pay for everything. And when you throw student loans on top of that, proud holder of a portfolio of federal student loans, as you can well imagine, and my kids have one too. The enormous debt of getting through college is cutting into their retirement. And unfortunately, the federal government isn't doing anything to help that. I mean, when Wall Street can borrow at 3% and we have to pay 7%, that seems to be somewhat of an inequity.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Yeah. Paul, thanks. And you bring up, and thanks for the call, Paul. Paul brings up a really good point because there's a lot of kids like his who are in that exact situation.
Yeah, it's a great point. Kudos for them for being out on their own and trying to make it work. And I do believe there is a lot of free advice. It's one of our missions here at Cape Cod 5. It's to provide education and empowerment for those that, you know, are just starting out. The other thing I would mention, there's an awakening at the corporate level about these issues. And there's a lot of corporations, companies, organizations, Cape Cod 5 is one of them, where they recognize this. And as part of their, you know, their cafeteria benefit plan is, you know, helping them pay down, you know, as a benefit, as a being employee, pay down some of those student role loans. So that's another option. There are some government programs that do have loan forgiveness programs, so that might be something if they're interested in public service to look at. It can be complicated, but there again, a lot of good information on the website.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And so many companies and organizations offer retirement plans through managed plans like Vanguard, Fidelity, TIAA. I'm not sure it's called T or TIAA. If you're participating in one of those plans, do you still need a financial advisor?
It depends on your definition of financial advisor. So if you think of financial advisor as a investment manager, just going to manage your assets, probably not. Most 401k plans now offer target dates. So you're 40 or you're 30 or whatever your age is, you know you want to retire at 65, you do the difference and pick a target date fund that is going to roughly align with your target date of when you're going to retire. Diversified, low cost, set it, forget it, you know, make your contributions, try to get out to that 20% would be great, or to max out the 401k limits, which is, I believe, $18,500 this year. So not necessarily from an investment management standpoint, wouldn't necessarily need a broker. But I think everyone can benefit from financial advice, from financial planning, from wealth management. So, you know, starting out in your 20s, college debt, you want to save for a rainy day, have a reserve account, you want to buy your own place, you want to reduce your college debt. Those are all competing goals. How do you optimize that? There's financial planning options that, again, are free or on an hourly or a retainer or a subscription basis. So it doesn't have to be expensive. In fact, it could be less expensive than the gym membership or your cable bill. Then as you mature in your 30s and 40s, you might have switched jobs a couple of times and have these stranded 401ks. You may be married with a mortgage now and young children thinking about college. And so things change, and life insurance might be something that is relevant at this point. Saving for college is more relevant. And as your needs become more sophisticated, I think, again, a holistic approach to that wealth management becomes more critical.
We're talking about starting when you're younger, and I can't remember this. I was reading something recently about the number of Americans who are, you know, over 50 and have not prepared at all for retirement. Yeah. So what happens when you're starting late?
Well, we talked about the magic of compounding,
right?
And that has, you know, that
you don't have much time for compounding.
You don't have that. And if you look at, you know, if you sit down and kind of assess the situation and you say, all right, if the goal is $1 million, just making this up, and you're 50 years old and you're at zero to a million looks almost insurmountable.
Right.
You know, how am I going to do this? I would argue don't worry about the end goal. It's much more important to just start the process. Start walking down the road, even if you're crawling. Don't worry about running yet.
It's something.
It's something. And certainly we'll have to readjust kind of the expectations. It's not retirement probably at 58 with, you know, a nice withdrawal.
You work until 70 at least, right?
maybe. Again, it depends on where you are in your life, what you can start saving now, what your expectations are at retirement. If you, for example, have a household income of $100,000 and you haven't started saving, but expectation is at age 65 to be able to spend $100,000 in retirement, that might be hard.
Yeah. You'd have to change your lifestyle.
You'd have to.
All right. So, social responsible investing is becoming more prevalent. So what is socially responsible investing?
Yes. Okay. Great question. Very broadly, social responsible investing is a conscious decision to allocate your investment dollars towards institutions, corporations, even bond fixed income that aligns with socially conscious roles and goals and responsibilities. It is an area of investing that has gained a lot of traction over the last few years ago, and listeners might be surprised that it's over $6 trillion in assets are invested in socially responsible investment strategies. There's many different investment strategies out there and managers that fit that criteria. So that's really kind of broad base. And so that might mean something along the lines where they treat workers fairly, that they're looking at kind of social missions in their corporate structure. So you can define it many different ways. Social responsible investing also covers a continuum. So I would say that's much more kind of broad-based, if you will, versus ESG, which is environmental, social, and governance. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit more specific, a little bit more narrower, and fewer companies, if you will, would meet that type of criteria. And then probably on the opposite end of the continuum is impact investing, where it's very specific. You want your dollars invested in managers that are trying to have a impact in any particular area or on any particular governance within that company.
So are returns comparable to more traditional investment options?
That's a great question. So you would think, right, as the field narrows, mm-hmm. that you would give up something in terms of performance, but that isn't the case. What we have found is that there's a strong correlation to higher social responsible and ethical management of a corporation and performance. And so intuitively that would make sense, right? But that doesn't necessarily always shake out. Hmm. Well, looking at results and performance, if you will, on these types of investments versus actively managed investments that don't have this process, results are actually very similar or can be more favorable.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how are these socially responsible investment portfolios vetted?
It's a great question, and it depends on the mission. So again, generally, I hate to use terminology that's specific to my industry, but in this case, I'm gonna call it a screen. So you can screen these corporations based on criteria, and that criteria would have a social responsible bent to it. And then as you, again, go down that continuum, that screening criteria, the ability for a company to get through and make a match and become, you know, become part of the investable universe gets much more difficult. And then on the impact side, even more so. So, for example, maybe, you know, initially it's we don't want to own any stocks that are involved in gambling or alcohol or tobacco. I mean, those tend mm-hmm. to be the big ones. But now you can even dive a little bit deeper. Maybe it's we want investments that are completely fossil fuel free. And then you can go even deeper than that. So you could eliminate ExxonMobil, but what about the companies that maybe sell goods and services to ExxonMobil? How does that meet your mm-hmm. mission?
So it's complicated, yeah.
It can be complicated, and it can be very customized. Mm-hmm. We have social responsible investing strategies available at our firm. We're also doing a seminar mm-hmm. Here in the area coming up in May on May 3rd.
May 3rd.
We're going to have a something here in the Falmouth area and over in Martha's Vineyard. Oh. And so we'll have that information up on our website, kickcod5.com.
We'll have to get keep our eye on that.
That'd be great.
We are talking about financial planning with Jason Lilly. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about financial planning with Jason Lilly, who is the head of the Wealth Management Department at Cape Cod 5. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned this $1 million that you're saying. That's kind of been the rule of thumb. You need to save $1 million by the time you retire. So with people living longer, cost of living increases, has that figure changed, or is that still what we're shooting for?
Medical expenses is another big one. Medical expenses growing much faster than inflation. So how do you manage all that? I think Fidelity is the most recent piece that I read that estimated medical expenses in retirement to the tune for a couple close to $300,000.
Mm.
That's a big number. That's a lot of money. So how do you manage that? Is $1 million enough? I don't want to scare listeners away that haven't started saving, because $1 million looks pretty daunting to begin with. Mm-hmm. It comes down to lifestyle and expectation. So a general rule of thumb is 4% of your portfolio is what you can spend each and every year. General rule of thumb, but it's a good proxy. And so if we use that on our $1 million, it suggests $40,000 per year, and you have a reasonable assurance that you're not going to run out of money. Not guaranteed, but a reasonable assurance. So you have $40,000 there. There might be some pension, income, Social Security. We add those up. And what does that look like relative to what you think you are going to spend? And if you do your budget work now, you have a pretty good sense of what you'd be spending in retirement. And let's say that you're making this up, are spending $100,000 now, but 30 of that is your mortgage housing costs. And you know in retirement, you're going to have that will be paid off, or you're thinking about downsizing. You're within that kind of that guideline. You should be fine. It's now just getting to that $1 million.
So, and then once you've retired, are the difficult decisions for investing done? I mean, you sort of change your thought process there, because now you're not looking, you know, for this compound interest anymore. So, what happens once you retire? What are we paying attention to as far as our investments are concerned?
I would say that at retirement, so those 5 years before and those 5 years after retirement are the most critical. It gets even more complicated when you're at or in or close to retirement. And here's why. You no longer have a 20, 30, 40 year career, right? Mm-hmm. We call it human capital. That human capital, your ability to generate income is pretty much over at this point or close to. So you don't have that element. You're no longer saving into your retirement accounts, but you're actually withdrawing. And so investment miscues, shall we call them, are manageable when you have more time to recover and when you're adding, again, that personal rate of return versus market returns. Once those are gone, it becomes a lot more concerning. It becomes, it's much more impactful making sure that you have the right mix between stocks, bonds, cash, that you are diversified, that you're spending thoughtfully. And I don't just necessarily mean you're meeting that 4% rate, but there are ways to spend through your different savings vehicles that can actually get you better after-tax performance and ultimately allow you to spend a little bit more or a little bit less.
So if you've saved, thinking of, you know, through your company, and you've got, you know, the Fidelity or the TIA or whatever, and as you're saying, there's sort of this target date and you don't really have to think much about it, it's not a bad idea then, as you're approaching that retirement age, say 5 years out, if you don't have a financial advisor, or to get just some sort of, even if it's a consultation, like you say, sometimes you can go in and talk to somebody one time and just sort of get some idea of, okay, I need to be thinking about how this is going to change.
Yes.
That would be a good time to think about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So that gets back to something we mentioned, a couple of the questions or a couple of things you wanted to look at as far as certifications. But are there things, certain questions you want to ask these advisors?
Yeah. Thank you for getting back to that. So 5 really good questions. We talked about experience and credentials. Standard of care is another one. So this idea, we talked about fiduciary and acting in the best interest of the clients first and foremost and always. But that is one version of what's out there. The other is this suitability standard, and that is much less strict. So you want to know when you're speaking with this advisor that could be doing different things, because we know that the titles aren't consistent, how they operate. Is it under the suitability standard? Doesn't mean it's a red flag, but it's definitely a yellow flag. You want to learn more. Or is it the fiduciary standard, which should, you know, be a green flag? How you get paid, or the way you get paid, really, really important. So
fees versus commission, is that what you're talking about?
Fees versus, but there's also other ways. It could be a retainer. It could be a one-time planning engagement. It could be a subscription service. So there's many different, and I've never worked under the commission structure. So I can't, say it better or worse. But generally speaking, commission tends to be more transactional based, less relationship based. The percent of AUM tends to be much more relationship based and more on the fiduciary side of things. Doesn't guarantee there's bad actors in either area, but you want to understand. I guess the way they get paid isn't necessarily as important. The how they get paid isn't necessarily as important as the way they get paid.
Way, okay.
And if they can't explain that clearly and easy to understand, probably want to move on.
Okay.
The other one, custodian. Who is their custodian? You want a third-party custodian. This is the Bernie Madoff issue. Mm-hmm. He had another company that acted as custodian, so they could change the numbers. A third-party independent custodian guarantees that those assets are titled in your name and you're the owner. So that's really important. So you want to understand the custodian. And then look at the firm background. So if it's a registered investment advisor entity, they have to have an ADV. And you can find that at sec.gov. Typically, you can find it right on their website. It's a 20-minute investment to read that ADV, but incredibly valuable. Mm-hmm. You'll see if there's any. You'll see how they get paid. You'll see assets under management. You'll see how long the advisors have been at the firm. You can also look to see if there's been any incidents or allegations against that particular advisor. If it's in the broker world, broker check is another one where you can look back and see history. If there's
so easier now to check up on this than it used to be.
Yeah, it is. In fact, you can do a lot of research online.
Yeah.
You can go to the firm's website and you can learn quite a bit. And I guess the final point would be, once you've done all this and you've narrowed it to 2, 3, maybe 5 that you feel comfortable with, make appointments. Mm-hmm. If they won't see you, 30-minute free consultation to get to know you, probably not the right fit. Every advisor should be willing to do that. And ultimately, all else equal, it should come down to that connection, who you really feel most comfortable with.
So late last year, Congress passed and President Trump signed new tax legislation. What are some of the key provisions or changes? How might this new tax law impact the way people save, invest, or allocate expenses?
This was a major, major change. Huge legislation. I think most likely almost every taxpayer is going to be impacted some way or another. And I think on our website, also on your website, we included kind of a hit of a dozen or so what should be positives, what might be negatives. So that's one thing to look at. But I'll give you a few of the positive ones. Most tax brackets for joint filers all the tax brackets have been compressed. And for joint filers, ranges have expanded. So basically, we should be getting a tax benefit for the most part. Again, I'm generalizing here, not for everybody. Okay. Probably not forever. Actually, very good point. I'll come back to in just a moment. On the single filers, also brackets have been compressed, but so have the ranges. So they're not synced up the way they used to be in years past. Other thing I'll mention about rates in general, they are low by historic standards. And so one of the immediate changes we would expect to see and what listeners should be thinking about is reallocating. So if they have a 401k that has a pre-tax option and a post-tax Roth option for Roth 401k, it may today make more sense to add a little bit more to your Roth than to your pre-tax. Mm. So the big difference between the two is a dollar that you put in your pre-tax 401k is a dollar that isn't recognized as earned until you take it out. The Roth, it is recognized as earned, but it goes into that Roth 401k. It compounds tax-free, and when you take it out, you get to take it out tax-free. Mm. And so with this line of thinking, if we know tax rates are below historic standards, there is maybe a recent assumption that they could be higher when you're in retirement. You save and pay the tax now, you get to have that grow tax-free, and then you take it out maybe with higher tax brackets and you're unaffected. It comes out tax-free. So that's one option. So tax brackets lower. The other big change for the positive, standard deduction has doubled for joint filers, so $24,000, which means many more will start to just take the standard deduction and not itemize. Might be easier. Mm-hmm. Nonprofits have a concern that maybe that might reduce their giving. In our experience, over two decades working with individuals and families, my sense is that probably won't have an impact. Generally, the tax benefit of giving is lower on the priority list than anything else. So I would be surprised if that's the case. Another positive here, we know on the Cape we have a lot of retirees that tend to have higher medical costs. The threshold has been reduced from 10% to 7.5%, so that could be a good thing. Child tax credit increased from $1,000 to $2,000, and the income range expanded from $110,000 to $400,000 married joint. Yeah.
All right, let's talk to Doreen, who's calling from Falmouth, see if we can squeeze you in. Hi, Doreen.
Hi, Mindy. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the benefits of investing in broad market, low-cost index funds, such as the total stock market and total bond market funds that Vanguard and other organizations offer.
Sure. Thanks, Doreen.
Absolutely. Great question. My first part of my career was at the Vanguard Group, so I am a big fan of Vanguard. Yeah, low-cost passive investing is a great way to get broad-based market exposure. And so big advocate of that. At Cape Cod 5, we use passive investing in a lot of areas as well. Indexing or passive investing has done quite well over the last 10 years or so. So it is a great way to get low-base, broadly diversified exposure. The one thing I would just mention is typically you see a lot of like S&P 500 as a great index option, and it is. It tends to be larger cap base though, so you'll have exposure to about 500 companies. I would advocate for looking at something that has a little bit more diversification. So at Vanguard, they have this Wilshire 5000 total stock market index. That'll give you some exposure to mid-cap, small caps. And then you pair that with, they also have a international, all-world, ex-US. So those two funds for your broad-based equity, global exposure in proportions that you're comfortable with. And then they have a total bond market index fund. So with three funds, you could get exposure to 4,000 plus companies at very low cost, less than 0.1% per year.
All right,
not bad.
Doreen, thanks for the call.
Just make sure you rebalance.
Yeah. We have less than a minute left. So just kind of recapping, and we will have a link to your website on our website, CapeAndIslands.org. But just some quick final thoughts. There's so many questions we didn't get to, but we'll have you back. So
that would be wonderful.
So go ahead. 529s.
That could be a whole show in and of itself. So we'll have some additional information posted on both websites. The one thing I did want to mention is the SRI event. I think I said May 3rd. It's May 2nd.
May 2nd.
For both of those in Falmouth in the morning and then over in the Vineyard early evening.
All right. Jason Lilly is the Chief Wealth Management Service Officer at Cape Cod 5. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us understand a little bit more about financial planning.
I hope I was helpful. It was great. I appreciate you having me back on the show. It's always fun. Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.